Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Story of Nowhere podcast. As usual, I am Daniel McCarthy, your host, and I am in no way paid by Fox. You'll get why I need to say that in just a minute. I hope you're all enjoying your 2023, now that we're nearly one-sixth of the way through it. I'm having a good time so far, though I admit it is a little bit stressful. As some of you may know, my wife and I are having a baby coming soon. Our first. So we're obviously very excited about that, but it also means that we'll be in uncharted and expensive territory. Plus, we got trains derailing, factories exploding, trucks tipping over, AI chatbots threatening people's bungholes, and Project Balloon Beam going on, whatever the hell that's all about. So yeah, it's a weird year. There's an awful lot to think about. But hey, if you're just living for entertainment, you shouldn't have any complaints. Now, some of you may have noticed that, I don't know, about a week, maybe even 2 weeks ago, episodes 0 and 23 were re-released on your podcast app thingy. This happened as the result of an irritation. I got an email from Spotify saying I was using copyrighted material in those two episodes. And that really cheesed me off, you know? Like, really? That's all you guys noticed? No, hey, that was a really interesting episode, or, wow, cool, but... No. They just went right for the criticism. Haven't these people ever heard of the compliment sandwich? But that aside, I'm also not the biggest fan of so-called intellectual property. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Actually, that's a whole area of discussion that we didn't get into in the property episode a few shows back, but I really would have liked to talk about it had we had more time. If we wind up doing another property show, I'll definitely make a point to squeeze that subject in. But, like I said, I think it's dumb, so I wasn't too happy getting a copyright warning or whatever, but I also did kind of expect it. Frankly, I'm surprised I made it this long without one. I know it's a thing that these corporations get all serious about, and I've been flagrantly disregarding it for the entire history of this podcast. So I guess I got off pretty light, considering. So they nailed me for those two episodes. I either had to prove that I was not in violation of any copyrights, which I totally was, remove the material in question, or they would just delete the episodes, I guess. So I took the easy, but still annoying, way out, and cut out the trouble spots and stuck in some violin music. I'm not happy about it, but I didn't want to get the shows deleted. And, as a result of my fiddling with them, they got republished. So that's why they're back at the top of the list. I guess there is a silver lining to it all, though. As a result of these re-releases, more people have either re-listened to those shows, or have checked them out for the first time. And that's good, because I think those are two of the most important shows I've done, up there with the Doomsday Device episode, which may be my most important yet, if I may say so. And God forbid I have to sanitize that one. It would ruin my whole opening montage. But whatever. That's the good news. And also, more good news, the original proper versions of episode 0 and episode 23 are still up and available and will remain up and available at storyofnowhere.com. Episode 0 is at storyofnowhere.com/0. That's the word 0 spelled out, Z-E-R-O. And episode 23 is at storyofnowhere.com/spectrum. So you can always listen there or download the actual audio files there for every episode I do. That way, when ChatGPT or Elon decides to turn the internet off, you'll still be able to listen to me talk about the British Empire, or the end of days, or whatever. Because you guys didn't really think I was just uploading all my stuff to these third-party platforms, but not backing them up anywhere else, or making them available to you in case I get kicked off of those platforms, right? I mean, who do you think I am, Alex Jones? Speaking of preparing for the inevitable, I should remind you to go over to storyofnowhere.com/library to check out the books I've got for sale there. Still got some more coming up, and remember that I will also be taking requests for books to publish or republish. Just email me at nowherelibrary@mail.com so we can sort that out. Don't underestimate the importance of having physical copies of data. Also, check out roadtohellfilmreviews.com for my buddy Nikki Pease and my sci-fi dystopian movie show. We just reviewed 1995's Johnny Mnemonic with Keanu, and coming out soon will be our discussion on the excellent 1987 film RoboCop. Okay, so now that that's out of the way, this is a short, sort of off-the-cuff episode today. It's been far too long since I've done one of these, and this one may be a little weird. But hopefully you'll get something out of it anyway. The other day, the wife and I were hanging out, and I was telling her about this book I've been reading. The book, it's a non-fiction book, is all about covert or clandestine operations back in the 50s and 60s. It mostly has to do with the CIA and its secret Cold War activities in Cuba and Vietnam, but of course those CIA guys were all over the place after World War II, man. South and Central America, the Middle East, Eastern and Western Europe, the American media, for Christ's sake, everywhere. So we were talking about that. How there are these things, these activities, what the CIA tellingly calls fun and games, that go on behind the scenes, that reflect the agendas of those who truly hold power in our world. Truly hold power. I'm sorry. I don't care how fulfilled your I voted sticker makes you feel, but an unelected agency which can overthrow governments has more power and geopolitical significance than you or any one of your precious representatives. And of course, by you, I don't mean you, the listener. I'm sure if you've somehow come upon this very obscure little show, you probably already understand this. But you probably also know some people who don't understand this. And if you're like me, you find talking about politics with these people, and of course all conversations have to be political these days, you find those conversations really goddamn annoying. For this type of person, the so-called normie, the concept of true power lying behind the throne is preposterous, even though it's demonstrably true. These people are so afraid of falling victim to conspiracy theories that they get caught up by the most preposterous one of all, that gigantic, multi-million or even multi-billion dollar campaigns in which a man or woman seeks one of the most powerful positions on planet Earth operate totally above board and exist only to deliver the best possible lives to as many Americans as possible. These above-board candidates and their above-board campaigns work with, that is, conspire with, media companies, which certainly are only interested in giving the people the straight dope, so that the people can get a fair, nuanced, and objective view of each candidate's plans. Then the adult population all gets together and on one day decide which candidate best deserves to wield power. And then, by God, he tries his best to get it all right. It's a grand conspiracy of public and institutional competence and benevolence of absolutely epic proportions. Talk about fucking nuts. The exercise of power is far more subtle and pernicious than that happy civic story we are all told about when we're young enough to believe in Santa Claus. I've said it before, and by God, I'll say it again. The realm of true power, deep politics, or the deep state, has its own ecology of cooperating and competing interests, none of which are concerned with your or my well-being. Sure, maybe from time to time you or I will benefit, but that'll be incidental, only because our benefit at that time suited some other larger agenda. The deep state is an opportunistic, morally bankrupt jungle. There's bribery, blackmailing, and backstabbing going on constantly. Now, to some, this accusation may sound crazy, but in fact, all it really means is that even at the highest echelons of power, people are still people. Not evil reptilians from another dimension, but also not selfless, if occasionally incompetent, angels. They are human beings, acting as human beings do in a high-stress, high-stakes environment. This is no outrageous conspiracy theory. It's the most natural thing on earth. But even though most people actually do understand that politics is dirty, they have a hard time wrapping their heads around how it can be so systematically malicious. What these people don't understand is that the deep political jungle is a very high-stakes, high-pressure arena, and under such circumstances, it would actually be crazy to expect people to behave in a manner that you or I would call normal. I'm not saying this to justify or absolve anyone of anything. I'm just saying that, basically, the only way to survive in the deep politics jungle is to be a debased, backstabbing piece of shit. But unfortunately, the average person has no reference for the world of politics. Sure, there are movies and shows which purport to be realistic depictions of the political world, but even if they are accurate, they can be easily dismissed as just fiction. What people need is something real, something fairly close to them, which mimics the deep political environment. They need to see how people will act in a highly competitive, dog-eat-dog, high-pressure scenario. To understand politics, what they need to do is watch a season of the show Hell's Kitchen with Gordon Ramsay. Okay, now hear me out. I know that might sound stupid, but just give me a chance. Everyone's been to a restaurant. Maybe not everyone's been to a fancy restaurant, like the one on the show, but everybody can identify with the restaurant experience. Also, a pretty sizable chunk of the population has worked at some level in the food service industry at some point or another in their lives, and certainly most people have spent some time in a kitchen, even if it's their own. Point is, kitchen work is relatable, and it's obviously stressful. Obviously. Anybody could see how having to perfectly cook multiple meals at a time while some dude is screaming at you, and while the people who are supposed to be helping you are constantly screwing up, might fit the description of high pressure. Also, the show is a competition. All the people in the kitchen are ultimately hoping to get rid of all the others. So that adds a layer of aggression and the potential for not just mistakes being made, but for intentional sabotage. So in case you don't know, this is a show that came on TV, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago now? I think it might even still be going, but anyway, Hell's Kitchen is a reality game show, I guess. Very strange for me to recommend such a thing, believe me. But if you can get past all the silly TV production stuff and the typical goofy TV announcer with all his hacky TV puns, I think you can actually get something out of this show. So here's how it works, if you don't know. A bunch of ambitious chefs arrive at the restaurant Hell's Kitchen. They're competing to see which of them is not only the best cook, but who can best manage a fancy kitchen. They're divided into two teams and then subjected to culinary challenges, such as taste tests and filleting competitions, and must also work as two competing teams to complete dinner service in the restaurant. So after each service, each team votes on two contestants to eliminate, and in the end, one is sent home and the others regroup and plan for the next challenge and the next dinner service. Aside from the team division, which is done at the start of the season, all of this constitutes one episode. Then it's wash, rinse, repeat, until there are only a handful of competitors left. Then they're all thrown on the same team, and then they all basically just do the same stuff that they were doing, but on one team now, until there are just two people left. In the very end, each of the two remaining contestants gets his or her own team, made up of his or her choice of previously eliminated contestants, and then the finalists go head-to-head in one last dinner service. At last, a winner is picked, gets a great job somewhere, and it's all over. To put it all in a nutshell, Gordon Ramsay, world-class chef and aggressive yet entertaining asshole, pits a bunch of cocky, lesser chefs against one another to see which of them deserves some job at a hoity-toity restaurant somewhere. That's it. Simple premise. Rise to the top, beat out the competition. But what's interesting to me, and I think useful to see, is that very quickly, rivalries and alliances form amongst the contestants. Some hate each other on a personal basis. Others freely admit that they feel threatened by so-and-so and will therefore try to get him eliminated quickly. They'll sometimes try to get each other out of the competition by sideways, tricky means. I don't mean tricky like they get them to sit on a whoopee cushion. I mean that one guy will make sure the other guy gets the blame for screwing up a dish or something like that, even though it wasn't really his fault. But then there are the alliances. Some folks will become friendly. But this is really interesting to watch too, because in the end, of course, only one can remain. So all alliances are ultimately temporary and situational. Also, the rivalries and alliances will sometimes shift based on evolving circumstances. The person you thought was your buddy puts you up for elimination. Now you're gunning for him. I'm telling you, if you can just get over the fact that this is a silly reality show and look at this as an opportunity to learn about human nature with regards to power, you'll get something out of this. And also, it can be fairly entertaining, too. Of course, Gordon Ramsay is an interesting character in and of himself, not just because I think meanness is funny, but because while he's paying attention to the food these people are cooking, he's also paying attention to the intricacies of how these contestants interact. It's really impressive, honestly. The guy is a true master of his craft. It's probably meant as a joke, but I've heard Curtis Yarvin say that Gordon Ramsay has the makings of a modern monarch. Now, I'm not all that impressed by Curtis Yarvin, a.k.a. Mencius Moldbug, but here he may have a point. Chef Ramsay exhibits an impressive organizational mind, and an appreciation for discipline, and an obsession with quality results. In fact, his presence in the kitchen on the show, as the final arbiter of what food gets sent out and who remains in the kitchen, may serve as a counterpoint to my argument. So, what I'm saying here today is that this show teaches us something about deep politics. But, one might argue, there is no end-all, be-all, the-buck-stops-with-me character in the cutthroat world of global politics. At least, there's no one man who serves such a capacity that I know of. If anything, Ramsay is the great equalizer. He floats above the lesser chefs and judges them according to their merits. Deep politics is not so simple. It's not so virtuous. Perhaps the show would be a better parallel to deep politics if Chef Ramsay were paid off by a few of the contestants and then participated in the petty drama by making sure the contestant with the best offer won. But not so. And I accept this criticism of my argument, but then again, my point isn't that Hell's Kitchen is a perfect representation of deep politics, only that it shows how people, the contestants, behave toward each other, toward the task at hand, and indeed, toward their objective arbiter, Gordon Ramsay, himself. So perhaps Yarvin is right. Perhaps what the inevitable deep political structure needs is a Gordon Ramsay type who can contain their petty squabbles and power plays and derive only the highest quality from such a flawed source. Then again, Gordon Ramsay won't live forever, and I don't know what his kids are like. So, I'm not quite sure I want to endorse King Gordon I just yet. If you nitpick the details, then yes, you will very quickly find how different Hell's Kitchen is from actual deep politics. But if you calm down a bit and think about the larger point and open yourself up to educational opportunity, then I think you can get something out of it. Have I said that yet? Here's something I noticed while watching this show that I think has political parallels. From what I've seen of this thing, the contestants don't ever think to write out a list of criteria for selecting someone for elimination. As I said, after each dinner service, the contestants vote on who deserves to be sent home. Now, I think the absence of a rote law is due to two things. First, at the time of the proposal, it might seem self-serving, and therefore not be agreeable to the other contestants. Say, for example, we have a contestant named Debbie. She isn't going to propose a rule that they should put more weight on communication ability than on serving properly cooked dishes, because she and everyone else knows that she undercooked a few dishes during dinner service. But she's a really good communicator. The other reason I think the contestants don't propose a set of rules is an unconscious recognition of the fact that any hard and fast rules may come back to bite later on. Contestant Jimmy isn't going to say, even if someone has been pretty good throughout the competition, poor performance during one dinner service should get you kicked out, because he knows that down the line, he might have a bad night. There must be no written rules, because those rules would hold everybody to a sort of transcendent, objective standard. Instead, everything must be kept vague, so each contestant can justify to himself his self-serving mental and argumentative gymnastics when he is suggested for elimination. The situation must remain fluid and open to interpretation, so each contestant can retain the almost Hobbesian freedom to mercilessly argue in his own favor, even when he clearly deserves to go. He can wave off his own error as an honest mistake, even though on the previous episode, when somebody else committed the same error, he declared it a mortal sin. Because they all share this implicit, self-serving motive, the contestants never define criteria for elimination at the outset. What that reveals is a strategy for navigating a high-stress, high-speed, high-pressure environment. I find that interesting, and maybe useful. So there's that. Here's another reason to watch this show. Imagine you've got a table at a nice restaurant, or maybe even at a marginally okay restaurant. You're sitting there with your date, you're dressed up and in a good mood, you get your drinks, and you're chatting. There are other people around, and you're people watching. You're wondering about the guy sitting alone in the corner, and are placing bets on whether or not the drunk lady is going to topple over before she gets her next drink. Then you get your appetizers. Pretty good. Your date has to send hers back because it came out cold, and that's a little annoying, but you laugh it off, and soon enough, a replacement arrives. Then you get your entrees, and they're delicious. You stuff yourself full, have one last drink, pay your bill, and hopefully head back to her place, isn't that right, fellas? I'm just kidding. We would never. Ah, you had a good night. Sure, there was the hiccup with the appetizer, but hey, that's okay. Besides, it only makes the night more interesting. You have no idea that while you were talking about your childhood, in the kitchen there is absolute pandemonium. Friendships are breaking down, fingers are getting sliced, wrists are getting burned, and you have no perception of the fact that it took the kitchen staff 4 hellish tries to perfect your entree, or that your date's appetizer hiccup just cost somebody a potential career. You're simply not aware of the drama, the misery, the tension that is thrashing behind the scenes of your nice night out. But it's all there. The same is true of politics. Think of how all the Machiavellian aspects of human nature manifest there. So let's use the restaurant as an analogy for deep politics. The people, the customers, are treated to the finished product of what takes place behind the scenes. We, the people, get the grand statements and the bill proposals already stated and already proposed. We aren't privy to the hours of deliberation, much less to the intense special interest negotiations that set the terms of the bills and statements. We don't see that the chairman of the such-and-such corporation had a hand in drafting the so-and-so bill. We don't hear that the head of the whatcha-call-it department, who is the former CEO of the what's-its-name corporation, met with the chairman of the such-and-such corporation the night before the bill was announced. And even if we are told who met who, very rarely do we ever find out what was actually said in their meeting. A lot goes on behind the scenes. This is true in the restaurant business. Any diner should be able to understand this. This is also true in politics, the difference being that in a restaurant, the customer reasonably expects to get a good meal, even if it takes a few sendbacks and retries. In politics, unfortunately, complain all you want, but you're getting whatever plate of slop the kitchen serves you. I guess this is ironic, because according to an unfortunately large contingent of Americans, this country is a democracy. I know it's not actually supposed to be. Listen back to episode 7 to hear my takedown of that. But the fact remains that a whole mess of Americans think the USA is a democratic country, or at the very least, they think it ought to be. Democracy, many think, is the ideal that we are striving for. But to re-employ the restaurant analogy, a true democracy would be like if each diner in a fancy restaurant had a camera looking into the kitchen. Not only this, each diner would be able to vote somehow, not only on how his dish was made, but on how everyone else's dishes were made. But this is simply not the case, nor should it be in a restaurant. Now, whether or not you believe the equivalent ought to be so in politics is up to you. But as things are now, this is not how it is. Politics, like a kitchen, is not a democratic environment. And I would argue, nor can it be in politics. At least in a restaurant, which doesn't pretend to be democratic, you can actually expect to get what you ordered. But in the restaurant that is politics, if you're served the wrong dish, they have men who come out and force you to eat it. Now, generally, I like to think of politics in very pure terms. Personally, I define politics with a capital P as ethics in the aggregate. That's the ideal study of politics in philosophical terms as I see it. But in the real world, politics with a lowercase p is the pursuit of power. At least, this little p politics is the corrupted version of big P politics that occurs when people aggregate into gigantic state-managed societies. I think that this pursuit of power necessarily gives rise to a deep state or deep political structure, regardless of whether the mass society chooses to call itself a monarchy or a communist republic or a democratic republic. Essentially, I accept what political theorist Robert Michel called the iron law of oligarchy, which is to say that all organizational systems naturally tend toward the rulership of the powerful few. Now, I'm not saying I endorse this or that I wish it to be true, only that I observe that it is true. I think it's reasonable to say that this idea implies that within the small rulership class or deep state, there are contests for even higher degrees of power. That within the overall powered niche, there exists a niche of superpower, toward which even those in the deep state must either strive or acquiesce. So, Hell's Kitchen. It's a show about human beings who choose to operate in a high-stress, high-stakes world. They ally with and compete against one another, all with the ultimate goal of rising to the top of the hierarchy. Like the corporate and political species within the deep state ecology, these chefs are far beyond the ordinary man or woman. But, also like some of the quote-unquote members of the deep state, each seeks to rise to the top of his already top-of-the-line niche, to not only be on top of the bottom, but to be on top of the top. This show is all about how people behave when that is their aim. If you watch Hell's Kitchen and see how crazy people can get when all that's on the line is some rich prick's beef Wellington, then I think it becomes a little bit easier to wrap your head around the craziness of people who are seeking power over a country of 350 million individuals, or the craziness of somebody who is willing to orchestrate or take part in a covert and illegal land invasion of a sovereign foreign country with the express intent of toppling its government and installing a puppet regime. If you think this episode is stupid and scatterbrained, well, fine, maybe you're right. I mean, it is a silly network reality show I'm talking about that I remember seeing on my grandma's kitchen TV. It's kind of hokey, and it's certainly indulgent. Small portions of super expensive food ain't exactly my bag. The amount of food that must go to waste when making this show is maddening. The silly keep-your-attention, quick-cutting, and occasional special effect detailing, not to mention the overly dramatic selective editing, can be kind of distracting. The contestants can be a bit much sometimes, and you gotta wonder how much of the interpersonal drama is staged. Also, you may be left wondering what was left on the cutting room floor. You've also got to wonder just how much of it all is real. You know? Like, is the whole thing just a setup from day one? Maybe. I don't know. I doubt it. There definitely are some things that come off as staged, but I'm not going on the internet looking up exactly how real it all is, because I think that would kind of be missing the point. And, frankly, I don't think that much about this show. And besides, why fake drama when that's just how people are anyway? It seems cheaper to just let the show go organically. But I get it if you think I'm making too much of it here. But on the other hand, if I may indulge myself a bit, I think that if one is to get an education, one must be open to finding it in unlikely places. As longtime listeners will know, I'm an admirer of the late John Taylor Gatto, who emphasized this exact mentality. As he said, an education is not given. It is taken. I don't think of an education as something that only is produced in a formal setting, like a library or a classroom. I'm a firm believer that you can get educated by standing on the street corner or walking through the woods or staring at flies swarm a bag of dog shit, or by watching a silly TV show. That said, there is the phenomenon known as apophenia, when one sees patterns or connections where there are none. So, you know, look out for that. Try not to read too much into things. But I don't really think that's what I'm doing or talking about. I'm not suggesting that Hell's Kitchen is secretly a show about the nuances of politics. But I do think it showcases how people behave in high-stress settings. On that basis, I think that it may have something to offer concerning the high-stress ecosystem that is deep politics. I don't think that it's a perfect parallel, not at all. But in a behavioral way, on certain levels, it is actually analogous to the exercise of political power. When my soon-to-be-born daughter gets a little older, and it comes time to teach her how things work in the high reaches of power, I think I'll leave aside the schoolhouse rock and throw on some episodes of Hell's Kitchen. And no, I really mean it. This episode isn't an ad. Fuck Fox, fuck hell, fuck cooking, fuck kitchens, and fuck Gordon Ramsay.
Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah. Someone's in the kitchen, I know. Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah, strumming on the old banjo, singing fee-fi-fiddly-i-o, 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 strumming on the old banjo. Thank you.
kitchen, I know. Someone's in the kitchen with Dinah, strumming on the old banjo, singing fee-fi-fiddly-i-o, 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 strumming on the old banjo. With